Matthew 2, 1 through 12. Now after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, saying, "Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him." When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. And assembling all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. They told him, "In Bethlehem of Judea, for so it is written by the prophet, 'And you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel.'" Then Herod summoned the wise men secretly and ascertained from them what time the star had appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, "Go and search diligently for the child, and when you have found him, bring me word, that I too may come and worship him." After listening to the king, they went on their way, and behold, the star that they had seen when it rose went before them until it came to rest over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. And going into the house, they saw the child with Mary his mother, and they fell down and worshipped him. Then, opening their treasures, they offered him gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh. And being warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they departed to their own country by another way. This is the word of the Lord.
In Luke chapter 2, the doctor, Luke, he records another story, not the one that we'll cover, but it's a famous story. I mean, you've heard it. It's the shepherds are in a field watching their flock by night, and then an angel shows up. One angel shows up, and he begins to announce this great truth that the king has come, that Jesus has come. It's this unbelievable pronouncement. I mean, it's an angel, right? And I was thinking about that this week, that I get to do what an angel did. The angel was the first one to speak the message that I'm called to speak today, to announce to you that the king has come, that we don't have a God and we don't worship a God who's this distant deity that just kind of separates himself from his people and leaves us in our mess and leaves us in our suffering. He just kind of winds the clock and lets it go. That's not what we have. We have a God that draws near, a God that comes, a king that has come. And I'm in the line of, you know, an angel preached that first sermon. And so I just got really excited thinking about being able to preach that this today. And then I also got a little bit freaked out about that, because that means I have to follow up an angel. You know, if you think about having to follow up the angel's sermon, that's not exactly easy. You just kind of come up and it's like, "Hey, the supernatural, shining, freaky thing that just showed up and made us all scared and told you about Jesus, well, I'm just going to, you know, same thing. God's here, and there's a king here now." And it can't be that good of a sermon when you follow up an angel. But it's this audacious task, but it's this exciting task as well, because we get to, again, remember this great truth that our God has come. Now, your task is no less difficult, because right after the one angel pronounces that first message that the king has come, a whole host of angels show up in response to that truth and worship. And so that's what we get to do. When we're done here, we get to do that. It's sufficient for one angel, one preacher, to share with you the message of what has happened, but it's not sufficient that only one respond, but a whole host of us need to respond in worship to this great truth that the king is here. And so we'll get to do that together this evening. Now, for a real quick thought, for some of you that are here that maybe don't quite buy into some of this talk, right? You're talking about angels, you're going to talk about wise men, and they're following a star. That just seems a little fantastical to me. If that's you, first, welcome. We're glad that you're here. We feel like we can walk with you through some of those questions that you might have. If you have just some skeptical notions of the scriptures and Christianity in general, man, we're in that with you. Let's go. Let's talk. Let's have those conversations. But I just want to say one thing, because we're going to talk about wise men, and we're going to talk about stars that are moving as the wise men follows it. And I just talked about angels talking and things like that. We're going to do that this evening. But here's the thing. Maybe you can't buy into that. Maybe you're not sure you like how God came onto the stage. Here's the one thing that I just want you to be thinking about as we go. Would you hope that the things that we're talking about are true? Is there something in you that hopes that this is true? Because the message of Christianity is this, that the God of the universe, the majestic, beautiful, glorious God of the universe, has come after his people, you and I, who have rejected him, and he has come after us to rescue us. Now, would you hope that that's true? Maybe you don't believe in some of the things that we'll talk about, but is that the type of God that you would hope existed? And that would be our hope for you this evening. And so we have a familiar text, Matthew 2, the story of the two wise men, not the three wise men. We'll get into that. The story of the wise men coming after the baby Jesus and looking to find this new king. And so here's our cast of characters. We've heard this before, but let's just review. You have the wise men. Now, if you'll notice, there are not three wise men or two. In fact, it doesn't say how many there are at all. We don't know how many. The idea that there was three came because there's three gifts. And so the assumption was, well, maybe there was three of them since they gave Jesus three gifts. The truth is, we don't know. We get the word magi from the Greek here for wise man. They're called magi, and they're not necessarily kings. We don't know that they were kings. What we do know is that they're influential, important, educated men that have come from most likely Persia, and they are astrologists in some form or fashion, perhaps experts in astrology. So you have the wise men. You have the wise men. Then you also have King Herod. We've heard King Herod. We've heard of that name. We don't know much about him if we've not looked into it. What we know about Herod is that he was a ruthless ruler. I mean, he killed everybody. He just was killing people. He showed up and he killed his sons. He killed his wives. He killed anyone that would dispute him. In fact, on his deathbed, he's about to die. He calls in his army, his guards, and he says, here's a list of 20 people. Bring them to me. They bring them into the room, and he says, when I breathe my last, I want you to kill these fools. Right? This was just a list of people he didn't like. And he's like, I want you to kill them too. And thankfully, they didn't, but that was just his nature. That's his character. Just a bad guy. Herod was just a ruthless killer. And then you have Jesus, of course. Now, Jesus was probably not born in December. He's most likely born in the spring, most likely in 6 BC. And when the Magi, when these wise men come to visit him, he's not a baby. He's, in fact, about 1 or 2 years old, somewhere in the middle of that. And so you have really these five things that we know from this story, from this text. But what Matthew chapter 2, these verses are saying is that Jesus is a king. That Jesus is not just any king, but a king of all nations, all peoples. That his kingdom is not bound even by earth, but it's a universal kingdom. And then fourthly, that because his kingdom is as it is, and because he is such a king that he is, he pushes out any other kings. There's no room for any other rulers when Jesus shows up. And so fifthly, then our only right response is joy in worship. But then in the middle of all that, there's this twist as well, as we'll see, in regards to the kind of king and how he comes. And so he is a king, and he's a king over all peoples, and he's a universal king, and he pushes out other kings, and so we should worship him as king. So first, Jesus is king. Look at verse 1 and 2. Now after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, saying, where is he who has been born king of the Jews? So they come to King Herod and they say, we're here to see this new king, this king born the king of the Jews. Now, why did they think he was a king? Well, it tells us, for we saw his star when it rose and we have come to worship him. Now, this seems strange to us that they would think that there was a king born because a star rose up in the sky, but this was actually pretty common understanding in this day for this culture, to think that if there was going to be a new king born in a land or something significant was going to happen in a people, that there would be a star that would appear, there would be something that would happen in the heavens to point towards that. Now, do we think that that's necessarily true all the time? Of course not. Did God maybe use that in this instance? It looks like it, but that's not, though this seems strange to us, it wasn't all that strange to these men. These were educated men. These were very influential men, very important men. They understood these matters, and it wasn't all that strange, even though it does sound a little bit strange. And so they come to see Jesus because they believe he is a king. Now, our idea of a king really, it doesn't mean much to us. I mean, we're in a democracy. All of us, for the most part, have probably only experienced that. We don't have kings. We have presidents and senators and governors. We can vote them in. We can vote them out. We can rail against them. We can dispute them. We have checks and balances. The only time we kind of run into the idea of a king or a kingdom is history books, movies, or maybe the news if we're looking at what's happening around the world. We've not really experienced that idea, and praise God that we don't have to. Right? If it just takes a Google search or a look at CNN to see that kings and dictators around the world, typically it doesn't go well for their people. It usually doesn't work out, that idea. In fact, Israel, God's people in the Old Testament, they at one time didn't have a king. All the other nations did, and so kind of like a spoiled child, they were asking God for a king. Well, all the other nations have a king. We want a king. And God was like, no, I'm your king. And they said, no, we need somebody to lead us. And God said, no, I lead you. And finally, they kept asking. And God said, all right. And so he gives them Saul. Saul was their first king, which turned out okay for a little while and didn't. And then it went really bad. And then King David shows up. That worked out okay as long as you kind of overlook the whole murder and adultery stuff. And then Solomon, his son, was working out pretty good, the wisest man that ever lived, until he started not doing wise things. He started collecting wives like some people collect coins. He had 1,000 wives. I don't know how you can rule anything. You can't even rule your house with 1,000 wives. And he was king over Israel. And from there, it got just worse. It went downhill from there. In fact, all in all, Israel had 43 kings. They had a divided kingdom. They kept getting taken captive by other kingdoms, by other nations. And by the time Jesus shows up as king, they were under Roman occupation. They had a semblance of national identity, meaning they weren't slaves, but they weren't really free either. Moral of the story, the king thing didn't go very well for them either. Now for us, those of us that don't understand really what it means to be in a kingdom, because we're in a democracy and that's all we've really experienced, well then what then does the truth that Jesus is a king, what does that have to do with our life? How is that relevant at all to what we walk through and what we experience as people in a particular place? Well, very simply, even though we may not have kings, we do have things that rule us. We've been talking about this all year, that there are kings, there are rulers that we've set up in place, we've given the throne in our heart that help determine really what we do, what we say, what we think, what we feel, what we're going after. That's what a king would do. A king would in large part determine your quality of life, where you would live and how you would live and what you would do and what your status might be. A king, it could protect you or he could oppress you. A king could be a tyrant, he could be benevolent. A king could provide for you, or a king could take from you. It mattered what kind of king it was. And many of us, we've set up similar types of kings and rulers, people and things that we run after, things that we have submitted our lives to. We've been calling them treasures over the last few weeks. And so we have rulers, we have kings. It's just not the historical type of king that we have been experiencing. We still have these things that own us, that rule over us. And so the message of Christianity is that Jesus is a king, that Jesus has come, and it's a new kingdom, and he's a new king, and he's a better king, and there's a new way of life in this kingdom, and it's good news. It's good news. And so Jesus is king. They begin to worship him, or they have come to worship him as king. But what we also see is that he's not just an ordinary king. He's not just a king over one people. He's a king over all peoples. These wise men, they are Gentiles. They're not Jews. They've come from Persia, perhaps Babylon. They don't know the God of the Bible. They don't know the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And they have come to worship Jesus as king. Why? Because Jesus' kingship and his lordship is over all people. The Apostle John in Revelation 7, he gives us a great vision of Jesus on his throne and people around his throne. And it's people of every race and every tribe and every tongue all worshiping Jesus as king. Why? Because he's king over all people, all nations. Not just one, not just Israel, but all of them. Christianity, it started in the Middle East. It started in Palestine. And then it began to move. It was a movement of this new religion, Christianity. And it moved into Roman Empire, and then into North Africa, then into Europe, then into Asia, of course, into North America. Now it's flourishing in South America. It's flourishing again in Asia. It's flourishing again in China. It's flourishing in Africa. It continues to move. Christianity has no center. It's global. Why? Because Jesus is king over all nations. other religions, they are centered by and large where they originated. Islam is primarily in the Middle East. It's where it started. 80% of Muslims are in the Middle East, North Africa, or Asia. Same thing with Buddhism or Hinduism. It originated, of course, in Asia. 99% of Buddhists and Hindus live in Asia. Christianity is quite different. Christians are almost equally split in North America, South America, Europe, Asia, and South Saharan Africa. In fact, the least amount of Christians live where Christianity started in the Middle East. Why? Because Jesus is king over all nations, over all people, not just one. And so Jesus is king, but he's not an ordinary king. He's this king over all peoples and all nations as well. And then thirdly, his kingdom is universal. Not to point out the obvious here, but there's a star and it's moving and people are following the star. That seems strange, right? I mean, we put stars on our trees, but these men are following the star months and months and months and months, leaving their family, leaving their homes to go follow this star. Apparently it was a new star or unusual enough for them to decide to do that. And then in verse 9, it apparently begins to move even from Jerusalem to then Bethlehem, where Jesus is. And I love how people try to explain away biblical phenomenon like this. This instance, perhaps the parting of the Red Sea, different miracles like that. You'll have scientists and secularists and people that will look into that and they'll say, here's how this happened. And they'll point to usually something that could have happened in nature, an anomaly that could happen in nature, something in that particular region. I was reading this article on the new movie Exodus, where Ridley Scott, the filmmaker, is talking about how the Red Sea could have parted. It could have parted because the strong winds could have come in this region, that could have happened, and then this condition was there, and if this condition was there, then something like the parting of the Red Sea could actually happen. And they kind of use these things as a way to say, well, that wasn't really a miracle, it was just something that happened in nature, as if our God is not God over nature. If those things are true, and a scientist said, you know what happened? Here's how the star moved from Jerusalem to Bethlehem, and here's where it appeared, and we knew it was going to appear there. In fact, we've seen this. It happens every thousand years or whatever. I'd be like, man, that's great. And it would not hurt our case in this matter or cause me any grief whatsoever in regards to the truth of this text. Because our God is a God over all creation. He's a king universal, not just over people, but over all things. What was Jesus' first miracle? Turning water into what? Right, or grape juice, unless you're Baptist, right? If you're Baptist, it's grape juice. If you're Presbyterian, it's wine. And he did that, and that seemed like an unbelievable miracle, and it was. But all he was doing is speeding up the process of what he always does to make wine or grape juice, right? Water falls from the sky via rain, nourishes the ground, grapes grow, boom, you've got wine after a few years, depending on how much you want to spend. Jesus calming the storm. Remember that story, the winds and the waves, and the disciples are scared. Man, these are trained, experienced fishermen, and they're freaking out about this great mega storm. And Jesus stands up and he says, "Be still." And then they get even more scared, but now this time at Jesus saying, "Who is this that the wind and the waves obey him?" But that's not that big of a deal. God calms all the storms. He's always calming storms. Every storm that ever has been, he was the one that said, okay, no more. This isn't something that should, it's just him quickening up the process of what he always does. Why? Because Jesus is king over all things, over all creation, over nature. Isaiah tells us that Jesus calls the stars by names, by their name. Do you know how he does that? He named them. Colossians 1, it says that all things were made by Jesus, and all things were made through Jesus, and all things were made for Jesus. And a couple of verses later, it says that he holds all things together. Hebrews 1 tells us how, by the word of his power, he upholds the universe. And so Jesus' kingdom, it's not bound even by earth, it's not bound even by people. Everything falls under the sovereignty, the sovereign rule of King Jesus. And so, yes, he's a king. Yes, he's a king over all nations, but his kingdom is also universal. He's a kingdom over nature. He's a kingdom. His kingdom is over all creation. The heavens declare the glory of the Lord, and the skies proclaim his handiwork. And since his kingdom is universal, there's no room for another king. Look at verse 3. In verse 3, you have Herod hearing this, and he was troubled, it said. Now, the translation here is a little bit weak. It means that he was greatly distressed, in turmoil, maybe even terrified. So you have King Herod, who hears of this new king, this king that the scriptures, the Old Testament scriptures, had prophesied about, and begins to get nervous about it. And then in verse 12, the wise men are warned not to go back to Herod to tell him where they had found Jesus, because they had heard in a dream that Herod wants to kill Jesus. And if you read on in the chapter, you'll see that Herod actually ordered the killing of all 2 years and younger boys in Bethlehem because he was afraid of this new king, this King Jesus. You never heard a Christmas story in that text, right? It's part of the Christmas story. It's part of what happened here. Jesus coming as king and immediately causing trouble, immediately being divisive, immediately kings are being pushed out. Why? Because there's no room for another king. And then Jesus, he wasn't there. He couldn't have been killed because an angel came to Joseph and had told him, hey, go to Egypt, be protected there. And Jesus sought asylum in Egypt as a refugee. Here's the point. There's no room for another king when Jesus shows up. The things that rule in our hearts, the kings that we've set up on the throne of our heart, if we know and love Jesus, there's no room for them. There's no place biblically for the nominal kind of, acknowledge God exists, Christian nice guy. The Bible doesn't let us land there. There's no category for that. It's Jesus rules and reigns over my heart, over my life, or something else does. There's no play there. And some of us, we still kind of play that game where we say, God, I'll acknowledge you as God. I'll acknowledge your existence. I'll even show up at your house a few times as if God is somehow appeased by some good deeds and church attendance. But I'm still going to cling to this, and I'm still going to hold on to this, and this thing is still going to rule over me, and I'm still going to treasure this. The Bible doesn't let us do that. Jesus doesn't let us do that. There's no room for other kings. You can't treasure Jesus in something else. There's no room for that. That's not the kind of king he is. If he's the king over stars and he rules and reigns over winds and waves, he's going to get you, all of you. And we either joyfully submit to his kingdom now or we stand under his judgment later. How's that for a Christmas sermon? What should our response be then? If he's a king, if he's a king over all nations, if his kingdom is universal and if he pushes out all their kings, what do we do? The wise men, they have a good response. I like their response. We should do what they do. Verse 10. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. This could be translated, they rejoiced with joy extremely loud. Or they rejoiced with mega great joy. Literally, that could be translated that. Like the only thing I could think of to explain or what this would be like to rejoice in such a way that they were rejoicing is either a gal whose boyfriend proposed to her and she kind of shrieks and freaks out and just really, really, really happy, like overly happy, almost annoyingly happy. In fact, it makes you unhappy how happy she is. Like that's the response. Or maybe having your first child, right? Second one, it's still happy, but you have one now. And so there's this joy that comes from that. Like that maybe is. Have you ever experienced something where you would define it, you would explain it later as, yeah, I rejoice with exceedingly great joy. That's how they respond to this king. And then they give Jesus expensive gifts, treasures, like gold. That's still a legit gift, right? Somebody give you gold Thursday, that'd work. Frankincense and myrrh, they don't sound all that great, but they were. We're talking about expensive, costly perfumes and oils. They have given him expensive gifts. They had laid down great treasures. And so how do they respond? Well, these wise men respond to Jesus as king by rejoicing with great joy and laying down treasures. Anybody see a paradox there? I mean, our treasures, these things that we cling to, these things that we hope in, these things that we pursue, these things that we protect, These are things that we have because we think they will make us happy. We think a relationship will make us happy. We think more money will make us happy. We think more sex will make us happy. We think more power or work or influence will make us happy or make us feel satisfied or whatever it is, exalt our name on high, whatever we're pursuing. We think those things will satisfy us. And yet these men have laid down their treasures because they'd experienced this great joy. We know deep down that those things actually don't satisfy because we've accumulated some, we've experienced some, we've attained some of that, and it didn't satisfy. So why would more of that, which didn't satisfy, why would more actually satisfy? Does a shiny new thing, does that make you happy? Does a better version of what you already have make you happy? Does more of what hasn't satisfied in the past, then make, is that the answer? We know that, but it still feels like we keep going after it and keep going after it and never just get down to the reality that those things actually won't do the trick. We think that those things will make us rejoice exceedingly with great joy, and it doesn't. The wise men are so filled up with joy, this truth that Jesus is this king, this great king, that they see everything else that they have as worthless. And so they lay it down. And so, listen really closely to this. Maybe be the only thing I would want you to take away if there was just one thing. The message of Christianity, the gospel, the good news of Jesus, who he is, what he has done, submitting to his kingship, walking in the kingdom of God, all that we're talking about, all that the Bible teaches, you need to hear this. It is always, always, always for your joy. Always. If your idea of Christianity is just the kind of stiff, boring, you know, tight-lipped, pierced-lipped, no fun dude that's railing against all the fornicators out there, if that's your idea of Christianity, that's not what we're talking about. It's not what the Bible teaches. The message of Christianity, what the good news of the gospel is God's people rejoicing in the glory of God. Christianity is about always your joy. Now here's the twist in all of this. You have a king. Right? You have a king over all people. You have a king universal. He controls and names the stars. You got this king that pushes out other kings and other rulers. Right? We're talking about great power here. We're talking about eternal power, comprehensive power, all power, rule and reign over all things forevermore, eternally. You have this God of the universe coming as king, but it's a coming, an advent filled with humility and rejection. I mean, look at it. Look at how humble the God of the universe comes. He comes as a baby. He shows up as a baby. And then he doesn't show up in a palace in Rome or even a nice house in Jerusalem. He shows up in Bethlehem in a manger. In verse 6, when they're talking about Micah's prophecy, it says that Bethlehem is the least of the land of Judah. Right? Bethlehem is this podunk town, right? Think West Texas or Oklahoma, something like that. Just podunk kind of town. And Jesus, he comes there. And he's a king, yes, but if you read later on in Micah, it says he's also a shepherd. That he comes as a king, but he also calls as a shepherd. Comes as a shepherd. He smells like sheep. He has to ward off wolves. He has to get with us and clean us and walk with us and be near us. He gets dirty. He comes humbly. And then he also is rejected. He's rejected by the political class in Jerusalem. He's rejected by the religious class in Jerusalem. That rejection continues until his death outside of the city walls on a hill called Calvary. They continue to reject him. His whole life was marked by humility and rejection. And so you have this God of the universe that comes as the king of all kings and the ruler over all rules. And you have this God who comes as king to where now our whole life is meant to orient around him. We're to lay down every treasure before him. We are to behold our king. We were just singing it. But he comes in such a gracious, humble way that we can submit our whole lives to him because we can trust him. He's not like the other kings. He's not like those things that have failed us. He's not like the kings that we've heard about historically or around the world that oppress us. He's completely unlike any of the kings that Israel had. We must submit to his kingship. The stars do. The winds and the waves do. But we can. We can trust him. He's a different king. He's not a tyrant king. He's a benevolent king. And so Christmas, this season, and this message that the angel got to proclaim and that I get to proclaim, it means that God willingly entered into our world, entered into our suffering, entered into the brokenness caused by our sin and others' sin against us. That's what it means. It means that our God, our King, didn't show up at a palace but got dirty. He didn't hide out with all the really important folk, but as a shepherd walks with the sheep, he draws near. It's an unbelievable truth, and it's why the angels said we should rejoice. It's why the wise men rejoiced with great joy. Why? Because he enters into the mess. He enters into the racial tensions. He enters into the life of the young gal who I talked with last week, who's wrestling with injustice and wondering about God's character. He comes alongside the woman who found out her husband is having an affair. He just sidles up next to the brokenhearted, who are just so fragile that one offbeat word, one moment of strife, and it could all shatter. He knows all of that. He experienced all of that. He entered into that. He enters, even now, into those things. And so you have the Apostle Paul who says that Christians, they can be sorrowful yet always rejoicing. Why? Because of Christmas. Because the King that we serve and the God that we proclaim is a God that drew near, who enters into the fray, goes to the front lines, lays down his life for his people, humbles himself even unto death, even death on a cross, and that his name is the name above all names, that stars obey, and that we will eventually bow before and call Lord, whether now or later. That's the King that we serve, and that's the message of Christmas. And so, what should our response be? Well, our response should be much like the wise men. Our response should be to join in with the angels in Luke 2. Our response should be to be so overjoyed at this truth and this reality that we surrender and lay down anything and everything that would keep us from more of this King. And so we can join in with the angels in response to this great news, who heard this: "For unto you is born this day a Savior. He is Christ the Lord." Let me pray for you. Father, thank you for your grace and mercy in the incarnation of your Son. God Emmanuel, God with us, we get to rejoice in that and celebrate that, and we get to respond to that right now. And we get to join in with saints throughout the world, from all nations and all tribes and all tongues and all races, who this week are celebrating this reality that you are King, and you are King over all people, and you're a good King. We get to join in with literally angelic beings . 1 Peter 1 says they long to look into these things. They are utterly amazed at the work that you're doing in us and through us by your Son and his work. Would we just for a moment get caught up in that? Just for a moment get caught up in the historical, eternal, epic, cosmic nature of what this season is actually expressing and proclaiming and reminding us about. We'll just in this moment get caught up in that. Some of us have never called on you as King. Would you reveal yourself in all of your glory and in all of your grace? They would know you. Pray these things.